I'm also going to follow Mark Peterson's excellent example and use a blackboard for a while. I won't be able to keep it up, but just to begin.
The light switch is up front there. It's the right of the coffee pot.
So, in an introductory physics course, literally a freshman physics course, we tell our students that the charge density, charge on a conductor, goes to the surface. By the way, nothing sophisticated here. Don't be thinking about external fields or anything. I'm talking about a conducting potato in outer space that's been there for a long, long time, and I slap some charge on it, and the question is the most elementary one: where does that charge go? And the argument that we always use for why the charge goes to the surface, well, inside a conductor, the electric field is surely equal to zero. I won't run through the argument for why that's the case. But the electric field inside the conductor is equal to zero. And then we appeal to Gauss's law that the divergence of E is equal to 1 over epsilon naught times rho. And so if the electric field is equal to zero, the charge density has obviously got to be equal to zero. And if that's the case, where is the charge? The only other place it can be is on the surface. So there's the proof, which is perfectly valid. But in my experience, freshmen are not altogether comfortable with Gauss's law, and they tend to bail out in the second half of the argument. So I found myself 1 year making what every teacher should know not to do, a seat of the pants analogy to try to convince the students that the charge on a conductor would actually, that it's reasonable that the charge on a conductor would flow to the surface. And I found myself saying that, well, imagine that you're in a room with no furniture but lots of very smelly people. And what would naturally happen in that room? Well, everybody, of course, trying to get as far away from everybody else as they possibly can. Pretty soon, everybody's plastered around the walls. And so it is with a conductor that the electrons, in this case, not because of smell, but because of Coulombic repulsion, are pushing themselves as far apart from everybody else as they possibly could from all the other electrons. And pretty soon, they're plastered over the surface. Seem reasonable, except that some clever students, of course, well, doesn't that seem like an awful waste of all the space in the middle? You know, if I was in that room, I think I would go to the center of the room where which sort of deflated the argument. Because in point of fact, it's true, of course. A few clever people would go to the center in that case. So I found myself wondering, what are the critical features that make the charge go to the surface? And as you probably know, it's critically, that rule is critically dependent both on the dimensionality of the system. It's not the case that for a two-dimensional system, like a plate or something, that a flat plate, that all of the charge goes to the perimeter. It doesn't. It preferentially goes to the perimeter, but not all of it. So the fact that the charge goes to the surface is dependent on the dimensionality of the object, is a three-dimensional object where it goes to the surface, and also on the 1 over r squared nature of Coulomb's law. Of course, if you tweak Coulomb's law, make it 1 over r cubed or something like that, then the charge does not go to the surface. And for both of those reasons, I reckon the people in the smelly room should not all go to the boundaries. Some of them should be in the center. Well, it's a fact well known to authors of textbooks on electrodynamics, but perhaps not so well known to the rest of you, that there are precious few examples in which one can actually calculate analytically the way that the charge distributes itself over the surface. We know that it goes to the surface for a three-dimensional object, but exactly how does it distribute itself over the surface? As I say, well, for a sphere, pretty obvious, yes. But try almost anything other than a sphere, and you will find that it's not in the textbooks, and there's a good reason for that. But there is one famous example that was well known to 19th century mathematical physicists, and I have found a very rich rich example to explore because it takes you many directions. This is the ellipsoid. If you take an ellipsoid, x squared over a squared plus y squared over b squared plus z squared over c squared equals 1, and slap charge on that, it is known exactly how the charge will distribute itself over the surface of the ellipsoid. In point of fact, the charge density is given by the formula Q, the total charge that you slap on there, over 4 pi times the product of the semi-major axes times the square root of x squared over a to the fourth plus y squared over b to the fourth plus z squared over c to the fourth. A very lovely formula. You'll find that proved in Smythe or Stratton. I think it's in Smythe by an absolute tour de force argument, the kind of argument that that once you see it is very beautiful, but you imagine how any mortal would ever have conceived of that way of getting a handle on it. You can also do it in a bulldozer method using separation of variables in ellipsoidal coordinates. But anyhow, that's the distribution of charge on the surface of an ellipsoid. You might think this is a peculiar formula because it ostensibly is a function of three variables in the surface. The ellipsoid, of course, two-dimensional. What's the third variable doing in there? Well, of course, x, y, and z are not independent on the surface of the ellipsoid. You can eliminate one of them, and suppose that we eliminated the z squared there by taking this c squared and multiplying it in, c squared, and making that a c squared, and then I could use the formula for the ellipsoid to eliminate the z squared over c squared in favor of 1 minus x squared over a squared minus y squared over b squared. So there's the much uglier formula for the charge density, but now written as a function just of x and y, more reasonable for the surface of an object. Now, the reason that I put this down is that I want to explore two-dimensional and one-dimensional analogs, which one can extract from this by squashing the ellipsoid. If I take the z direction and squash it down, in other words, set c to 0, I can immediately read off what the charge density would be on a two-dimensional ellipse. Setting c to 0, this term dies, and I get the formula that the charge density on the surface of an ellipse now, a plate, is q over 4 pi times ab times the square root of 1 minus x squared over a squared minus y squared over b squared. Actually, not quite, because once you squash this down, of course, the top surface and the bottom surface coincide. So really, it's twice that as the charge per unit area on the surface here. Now, an example that you can do several things with this, stretch the second dimension out by sending b to infinity, and you extract the formula for the charge density on an infinite ribbon. But I'm not going to do that. I'll do instead a more obvious one, the charge density on a circular plate, which you could do by letting x squared plus y squared equal r squared and a squared equals b squared equals capital R squared, let's say. So r is the distance from the center and capital R the total radius of the whole thing. Well, then this becomes r squared. I'll pull one of them inside and make this an r squared and kill the other two, and x squared and y squared combine to make r squared. So I got sigma of r equals q over 2 pi r root r squared minus little r squared. There's the formula, actually a well-known formula that you can get by a number of other methods too, the formula for the charge density on a circular plate. Okay. Come back to my original claim that the fact that the charge all goes to the periphery is dependent on the dimensionality of the system. Here's a two-dimensional system. Does the charge all go to the periphery, all to go to the perimeter? No, obviously it does not, although it preferentially goes there. In fact, the charge density is infinite at the surface, at the actual perimeter, but it's not zero elsewhere. It's something or other. So now I'm going to give up on the blackboard and so there's my ellipsoid, the formula for the ellipsoid and the formula for the charge density on the ellipsoid. The reduction to a circular plate and a graph of the charge density on the circular plate. And sure enough, it pushes out more toward the edge, but it's not zero in the interior. Well, this raises the obvious question. What if you go one further, reduce one further dimension, and go to a one-dimensional object? You can do this in a couple of ways. The obvious way, you can actually take the ellipsoid case and shrink it down, two semi-major axes down so that it becomes a cigar and finally a needle, and get it that way. A little bit awkward to do it that way. And the first student of mine that I had working on a related version of this, I actually meant to mention that. When I said that very little is known about how charge distributes itself on the surface of a solid object, except that it all goes to the surface, there is one rule of thumb that we all know about that, and that is that charge tends to accumulate where there's a bump on the surface. And a few years ago, maybe about 8 years ago, there was an article in the American Journal of Physics that proposed to make that quantitative. I don't know how many of you saw this, but an article which claimed that the charge density on any object goes like the fourth root of the Gaussian curvature of the surface. A claim that it was, it doesn't take you long to convince yourself it cannot possibly be true. How it got published, I don't know, but it certainly was false, except that it happened to be true for the ellipsoid. So, and therefore for anything that's derivable from that, but in general, it certainly is not the case. Anyhow, I had a student that was working on this, the problem of seeing whether there was any quantitative way to formulate the rule of thumb that charge tends to accumulate toward a bump. And I'm now persuaded that there not only is there no such quantitative formulation, but in fact the idea is quite false. He came on several examples in which the charge does not accumulate preferentially where the curvature is maximal, on quite contrary, but that's a different story. But one, I know why I was distracted by that, is that this student, Jeff Kima, noticed a very peculiar fact about the charge density on an ellipsoid. Let's see if I can explain it. Suppose that you had the ellipsoid and it was actually a loaf of bread instead of, and you ran it through a bread slicing machine along any of the three principal axes. It may actually be true for other directions, I'm not sure, but along any of the three axes, you run it through a bread slicer that chops it into n equal width slices of toast. Fact of the matter is that the total charge on each of those slices is the same all the way down the line. And that's true for any ellipsoid, no matter what the relative dimensions are. And therefore, in particular, it's true for the limiting case of the needle-shaped ellipsoid. If you shrink two of them down, the net charge density, linear charge density, charge per unit length, is in point of fact uniform. It's a constant. A fact that struck me when I first saw it as so utterly counterintuitive that it absolutely had to be wrong. So the charge density from the ellipsoid, shrinking the ellipsoid, either doing the bread slicing technique or doing it by direct bulldozer method, the charge density is uniform. Not only does it not all go to the two ends, it doesn't even preferentially go to the two ends, it's uniformly distributed along the line. Well, it's easy to prove to yourself that that cannot possibly be true. Damn, I had some markers, but I didn't bring them with me. Can you switch that light on again?
There's a marker.
Hmm? Oh, you got a marker? Great.
It's just plain black.
Okay. Thanks. Here's an argument that's probably already occurred to all of you for why the charge density on a needle could not possibly be uniform. Because suppose that I focus attention on a charge that happens to be a little bit off-center there. That charge cannot possibly be in equilibrium, I claim, because, of course, there's all this uniformly distributed charge on the right. There's an equal amount, an equal distance to the left. Those two cancel each other, and there's a net force left over from all the junk that's down at the end. So how could the charge density on the needle possibly be uniform? Well, it turns out that is a diabolical example of the dangers of conditional convergence, if you ever want to explain to students why that argument, which sounds about as compelling as any argument you can make, is false, dead false. I had another, however, before I realized that it was false, which took about 2 years, I'm embarrassed to say, I had another thesis student, Ye Li, who had the ingenious idea to, given that obviously the charge distribution on a needle could not be uniform, that was the starting premise, what is it? Interesting question. You will not find this in any of the classical books, even though you would think that's an obvious problem in classical electrodynamics. Well, Ye had the very clever idea of discretizing the charge. So instead of slapping a charge Q and letting it smear out continuously, we're going to chop that charge Q into n equal bits and stick them on there and see where they go. So think about it. You just put a single charge onto the needle. Where does it go? Wherever it wants, because there's nothing else there to repel it at that point. Put two equal charges. Well, obviously, they go to the two ends. Three equal charges. Well, the first two are going to go to the ends, and the next one is going to go to the middle. Four equal charges. Well, this is already a non-trivial problem. Two of them will go to the ends. That's always going to be true, that the first two go to the ends, and the other two are going to be symmetrically distributed about the center, obviously. But how far from the center? Well, you want the net force on this due to this charge pushing it that way and those two charges pushing it the other way to be zero. That turns out to give you quickly a quartic equation if this distance is W, which there's the quartic equation. A is the half length of the thing, and W is the distance from the center. Solve it numerically on Mathematica, and that happens to be the number. But of course, you can continue that, put 5, 10. So yeah, what Ye did for his senior thesis was do this for 10, 20, finally made it up to 100. Terms. I don't want you to look at that for a second. And there's the distribution for 100, doing exactly what you would expect. So rabbit ears at the end, pushing charge out toward the end, and a fairly flat distribution in the center, but clearly not uniform. And in fact, we gathered a bunch of these together, put them on top of each other, and hold them up to the light. After you've got to about 15, you cannot discern any change at all in those graphs, from which I concluded, of course, that there's some universal function here, and spent probably about 6 months trying to figure out what that universal function was. It's nonsense. The universal function, a nasty case of very, very damn slow convergence that anybody could be fooled by, I think. But I had a colleague who had n equals 100, by the way, at the time took a weekend occupying Reed's mainframe. So we were not popular because, remember, for four charges is a quartic equation. I don't even want to know what it is for 100 charges, but it took a while, even with Mathematica, to draw those curves. But I had a colleague from Brazil who had somehow or other managed to get access to a Brazilian an underused Brazilian supercomputer, and he would literally send this stuff from Portland down to Rio or somewhere, and a week later would come out. Anyhow, he managed to do this for 32,767 charges there. The dashed line is 65 charges, and it's clear that you, even after you got to 65, where all the action seemed to be over, that's not true. You just have to go to very high number of charges. Well, I'm persuaded now, absolutely, well, from a number of arguments, that this thing is going to absolutely flat, but you'd probably need Avogadro's number of charges on there before you actually saw that happen. One reason why I'm persuaded of this is that I was on sabbatical in Berkeley, and I'm going to mention the problem to David Jackson, who got interested in it and did a very careful study of the charge distribution on a figure of revolution of finite length, but in the limit as the largest diameter goes to zero, but of arbitrary shape down the line. Did I say that in an intelligible way? Like you took a stick and turned it on a lathe and made that your, and then took the limit as the aspect ratio goes down to zero, and did a very elaborate calculation and came to exactly the same conclusion, that in the limit, regardless of the cross-sectional shape, in the limit as it shrinks down to zero, the charge density is uniform on that. He subsequently, you might have seen this in the American Journal of Physics, subsequently discovered that Maxwell had apparently understood this in his very last paper on electrodynamics. I'm not sure if it was ever even published, actually, but it's in his collected works. And Jackson stumbled on that by accident, looking for something quite different. But I've read the paper, and I think Jackson did it, and Maxwell did not, myself. Is that 10 minutes?
9 minutes.
9 minutes, okay. Let's see. So, what is the conclusion, then? For different dimensions, for 3 dimensions, all the charge goes to the surface. 2 dimensions, preferentially it goes to the rim, but not all of it. 1 dimension, constant. By the way, I myself believe that that's true not just for a conducting needle, a straight needle, but for a conducting noodle as well, regardless of its shape. I haven't been able to absolutely nail that down. Okay, but let's come to the other example. As I said at the beginning, that the fact that charge density goes to the surface is dependent on the dimensionality and also on the nature of Coulomb's law. So now I want to tweak Coulomb's law. This I did with another student, Daniel Jovanovic. First of all, replace Coulomb's law by a Yukawa potential, e to the minus mu r, where mu is going to be an adjustable parameter for us. If you set mu equal to zero, you should recover the Coulomb case. Should I ask you what you think for that case? The Yukawa case happens to be beautiful because it's a rare case in which I can give you I give you the answer, the complete answer for any shape of conductor, like as you can for the Coulomb one, but it's kind of surprising. For a Yukawa potential, the charge density is uniform throughout the volume. And then there's a skin also. There's some on the surface. How much goes to the surface and how much is spread throughout the volume depends, of course, on mu. When mu goes to zero, then it's all on the surface. As you crank up mu, more and more of it goes to the interior. Here is the specific distribution for charge with the Yukawa potential on a sphere. Here's the volume distribution, and there the surface charge distribution. And take it from me, those two add up, or rather integrate up. multiplied by the surface and the volume to the total charge Q. Well, that's one interesting case. I was very proud of it because, as a matter of fact, that can be solved exactly in general using a problem out of my E&M book that otherwise I thought was sort of a useless problem. But the formulas for the case of a sphere were not original to us. Those were actually derived by Spencer at Brigham Young University in about 1992, but he didn't seem to realize that it was true, that the fact that the charge density is uniform plus a skin is true for all shapes. He had it for a sphere and for a slab, but it's actually quite general. The second type of...
I'm sorry, is there any way to see that? You have this two-line proof for the Coulomb case.
Yeah, you got to know the first line is exactly the same. Yeah. What you need to know is what is the analog to Gauss's law for Yukawa potential, and that's the thing that was in, that's a problem I could show you in my book. It's del dot E plus, there's a term that involves the potential.
Okay, all right.
So throw this away.
Thank you.
It's very easy once you see how to do it, and if you fiddle with the Yukawa potential already. The other one is the other obvious case to explore, which Daniel did on his thesis with the power law potential. When n is equal to 1, that becomes the Coulombic case. There's nothing so clean that you can say about it. You can work it out for specific geometries, and I will show you the graph of charge distribution on a... This is actually done for a slab, but the formula is exactly the same for a sphere. So you could read this, the right-hand half, as for a sphere, if you like. Here's the different values of n. N equals 1.1. N equals 1 is the Coulomb case. So for that, it would be absolutely flat and zero along here, and then a huge spike at the end. But n equals 1.1, it starts to soften it out. The only interesting thing that I can say about the power law case is that, and this also was noted by Spencer, when you get to n equals 3, that's a potential that's 1 over r cubed, a field that goes like 1 over r to the fourth. What is interesting about that? I know absolutely nothing interesting about that. But the fact is, for the sphere, that gave, Spencer found that gave a constant charge density throughout the volume, but unlike the Yukawa case or the Coulomb case, nothing at the surface. That turns out also to be a general theorem, that for a 1 over r cubed potential, the charge on a conductor would spread itself, a conductor of arbitrary shape spreads itself uniformly throughout the volume and no surface charge left over. That n equals 3.
That's probably in 3 dimensions.
In 3 dimensions. Very good. In 3 dimensions. But by the way, mathematically turns out to be identical. The volume in 3 dimensions for n is mathematically identical to the one-dimensional case for subtract 2 from n. I didn't say that very well, but did you get the point?
Yeah.
So this happens to be the fact that it's constant there is exactly the same statement as the fact that the charge density on a conducting needle is a constant. Very non-intuitive in both cases. Well, I think I stopped there. Thank you. Yeah.
From your last remark, for n equals 2 in 2 dimensions, would you expect the same result?
Yes, a slab. Yes.
One over r squared potential on a circular disk would have a uniform distribution.
Oh, that's I'm not sure if I can do it that direction. No. Be careful about this, but I think for a slab, a two-dimensional slab, for n equals 2, it would be uniform.
Do we know? What happened to the argument that you couldn't have equilibrium with the static, with the uniform
That was all the argument.
The argument was false.
So why didn't I know that when you said it?
It's conditional conversion. What you because if you think about it, what I said was the force due to the stuff here obviously cancels the force due to the stuff here. Well, but unfortunately, both of those forces are individually infinity, right? Because there's a neighboring force, a neighboring charge here that's infinite, and there's one on the other side. So what I did was I took there's an infinite force to the left and an infinite force to the right, and I subtracted them and got three. Well, it sounds very plausible. Even after people have explained that to me, I thought, yeah, come on. Obviously, whatever this is, this part cancels that part. Well, you have to set it up more carefully. It turns out that on the one-dimensional object, all of the action is in the very nearby charge. What's going on out here is irrelevant. That's why I think, by the way, that the charge distribution is uniform on a noodle also, because locally it is flat. So, and I know from this experience that the distance stuff doesn't matter.
Correct. We actually have one question.
Sure.
You choose.
I just want to say that I was interested in the fact that you stopped at n equals to 3. I had a student, a decade ago, work on quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanical bound states of 1 over r to the n, where n varied. And the interesting thing is you could do computer codes. You started at n equals to 2, and you pull away, and it would work fine. And then suddenly everything would dramatically begin dropping. All the bound states went down to negative infinity.
At n equals 2 in that case, right? Run it the other direction, because
yes,
it's a 1 over x squared potential that's very...
You can only go 1 in either direction.
Yes.
And then in fact, he found an argument from the Virial theorem, which is very, it's one of these things that's very obvious once you discover it. That there are no bound states for a force 1 over r to the n, excuse me, for potential 1 over r to
squared.
The n, where n goes between n has to be within 1 of 1 over r to the n has to be within 1 of 1. It goes from 0.
I know the argument the other way, that 1 over x squared has no bound states unless you renormalize it, actually, and then you can get precisely one bound state out of it.
But it goes beyond that.
I don't think that there's a direct analogy to here, but it turns out between 1 and 3, it's a sensible question. Beyond 3, it's not a sensible question anymore. Or to put it another way, let's see if I can do this.
Maybe we can.
Yeah, let's do it privately.